from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Wednesday when Governor Andrew Cuomo came to Rochester, in town to discuss the state's lawsuit against the IJC. He spent some time discussing the Rochester City School District. He told reporters he is willing to do whatever is needed to help fix the system, including facilitating legislation and even supporting mayoral control. And while community and district leaders have different ideas for what will help solve some of the district's issues, they agree on several points: that the $30 million budget gap must be resolved and that student outcomes must be improved. The Rochester Coalition for Public Education is a local organization dedicated to sharing what it calls progressive education research with the public and with policymakers. The coalition uses evidence-based approaches to make recommendations, and this hour, members of the coalition join us right here to share their ideas for improving the RCSD. This conversation comes in advance of a community forum coming up two Tuesdays from now on the 29th of October, during which residents can weigh in on these recommendations. The goal is to create an action plan to encourage the Rochester District to adopt final recommendations, to move forward constructively. Let's welcome our guests here for the hour. Coalition coordinator and the retired principal of School Without Walls is Dan Dermasich. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Vicki Robertson, who's an RCSD parent and a member of the school-based planning team at Wilson Commencement. Vicki, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And Henry Padron is here. He's a retired School Number 12 kindergarten teacher and a former RCSD bilingual program director with an emphasis on English language learners. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hola.
Hola, bienvenido.
Gracias.
Vamos a tratar de usar mi español, but it's been a lot of years, so.
Vale.
Okay. So I want to start by going back to how Governor Cuomo framed what's going on here. And I think it's valuable to listen to what the governor is saying, because he is drawing distinct lines on what the options are and urging local leaders to pick one on this menu. Here's the governor last week.
I believe in the policy of constructive impatience when it comes to government. What it means is, don't tolerate the bureaucracy of government, right? If you see a problem, don't point fingers, do something, and do something quickly. The Rochester schools are in trouble. Yes, we know. They have been for a long period of time. Now, there are entities that can do something legally, and I would say morally and ethically. The Rochester City Council has the authority. They approve that budget. They can modify that budget. They can put conditions in that plan. This has been going on for years. Why does the City Council keep approving the same budget plan for the school district? The State Education Department, which I don't control, it's run by the Board of Regents, State Education Department can take over failing school districts. They have a number of remedies that are pointed to in the letter. They can put schools in receivership. They can put together a financial control board. So while those remedies are all dramatic and could be politically problematic, those are all viable options to start to address the problem. Do something. Pick it. Oh, we have a problem. I know. You also have the authority and the obligation to do something about it. To both the City Council and SED. Do you want to have, one assemblyman suggested, mayoral control? Do you want to put the mayor in charge of the school system? That would require legislation. I would support it. But you have a host of remedies that the City Council can do today, that SED can do today, and this is not going to be a situation where you make everyone happy with your solution, and that tends to stop government because they're afraid of the making anyone unhappy.
That's Governor Cuomo going over how he sees the options. So, Dan, I'm going to start with you. He's saying the options going forward are, number one, council can put conditions on the budget, not approve it, put stronger rules on approving funding. Number two, the state can put schools in receivership. Number three, they can appoint a control board. Number four, mayoral control, which he said he would support if local leaders asked for it. Those are the options. Do you see those as the full menu of the options?
I don't at all. And I think that what the governor needs to consider in terms of his recommendations are, one, do you really want to diminish democracy in terms of the participation of citizens of Rochester, especially those who are most disenfranchised and have a stake in this is more than anybody else? So one, in terms of let's do something but not diminish people's opportunity to participate in electing a school board. Number two, there could be a combination here in terms of what the governor is recommending. For example, the Board of Regents could appoint some facilitators who could aid the superintendent and the Board of Education in terms of achieving more progressive-related education goals that have not been tried yet. And third, in terms, one of the things that was not mentioned, other than giving the city council an opportunity to participate in terms of what money would be used for in the city school district budget, is the need for more funding. I know people complain at times that the district has a large amount of per pupil expenditures, but the sad fact is that given the poverty that parents and students are dealing with and the trauma that is caused through poverty-related conditions, even more money is needed for lower class sizes, more staff, more instructional resources, and just more aid to learning for these students.
Okay. And what do you make of the idea that we could see a push for mayoral control again?
I think that's the worst possible solution there could be. I mean, the first response to that is, what evidence is there through the research that mayoral control or a state-appointed board would work in terms of creating dramatic results? There isn't any that shows that it works. So that's the other thing that the governor and the mayor ought to be looking at. I mean, there's been, despite all the mayor's jawboning on this, there's been no plan associated with her drive for more mayoral control or takeover by the state.
Vicky, what do you make? In a moment, we're going to pivot. We're going to spend the hour on the recommendations that the coalition is putting forward, their ideas. What do you make of the solutions that have been kicked around, from the idea of a state takeover, receivership, mayoral control? As a parent, why do these stand out as poor ideas in your mind?
So I've seen the impact of receivership on schools, and it sometimes the extra money that receivership brings makes a difference in the schools, but it doesn't really make fundamental differences. When we talk mayoral control, why should taking away the educators being in charge, why would that work? I just don't see it. Is there a need to do something? Absolutely. We deserve better schools for the kids in the city.
Okay. Henry, how do you feel about some of these solutions that have been debated all summer now and into the fall here?
Well, I think it comes back to, even prior to what we're saying, is we need to have an informed community. We need to have a community that understands what this means, understands perhaps a jargon-filled meeting of someone saying this program, that program, this law, that law. It has to be a community that understands it in the language they speak and understand. In other words, the stakeholders in this are who? The parents, the taxpayers in the city of Rochester. I don't know if there have been meetings where these issues have been brought up continuously to explain it to our Spanish-speaking population, to explain it to our population from Somalia, from the Arabic diaspora, from Africa. These parents, what do they know about this? So it comes back to me that an informed community will make an informed decision. And we need to work at informing all the stakeholders who this will affect, because overall, it's been an English language approach.
One other question on the fundamental look at what's driving the results in Rochester. And I ask this because I think it's always instructive to understand where our guests on various angles are coming from in their mindset here. You know, the mayor hasn't been on this program for more than 2 years, so, but I'm very confident in saying that she views the schools and the RCSD as a primary driver of poverty. That, in other words, you want to fix poverty, you got to fix the schools. Whereas many other researchers around the country have said you can try many, many educational reforms, but when you have extreme poverty, when you've got children in poverty at a level that we see in Rochester with essentially no change for years, most reforms won't do very much to move any results in any meaningful direction. Which idea of that do you come down on, Dan?
Well, I don't think there's any question. The volumes of research out there support what you just mentioned.
The latter.
The latter, that income actually drives performance in school, and that the quality of a school in many cases is dependent upon who you go to school with. If you have kids who are suffering all kinds of trauma, if you have kids who are suffering lead paint poisoning, if you have all kinds of conditions that kids are coming to school with, your classroom is probably not going to be as conducive to learning as what you would like. It would probably be the best solution to that would be to cut the classroom size in half with more funding coming in for more teachers. The other thing is that there's all kinds of research now in terms of, and I know people don't like to hear this because it's an old story, in terms of desegregation, but the only the research that shows that the best thing that could work for kids would be massive desegregation. Now, what we have in our plans is a moderate plan that calls for voluntary inter-district magnet schools for suburban schools and city students and parents who are ready for that. They could do it on a pilot basis. And if it works, by God, we ought to do more. But all the research shows that kids who started back in the late 60s, early 70s, from poor kids of color families who spent 10 years, a minimum of 10 years, in desegregated schools were much more successful in terms of their jobs, in terms of college finishing, in terms of even their health. And white kids who were in the same school tended to maintain the same type of performance that they had before, but much better in terms of citizenship and diversity, tolerance, and respect.
When there's desegregation.
When there's desegregation, yes.
Do you think we've got a community that's prepared to really have an honest conversation on desegregation, Henry?
I think we have to also come at it from a historical perspective. If you look at the where we are today, and you... I may age myself. Go back to urban renewal, to model cities, to incentives for large corporations to raise entire neighborhoods and build a plant of this, of that, or that sort on land where families used to live. If you look back to the redlining of communities, the greenlining of communities, you will lay a map of 1960 on top of one of 1970 on top of one of 1980. And what you're going to see is the displacement of pockets of people and the compression of them into what today we call the arc of poverty, this zip code, that zip code. That was not a happenstance. That was a structured problem that has been created, that if we are going to look at the entirety of this question, we need to also consider the historical implications of where we are today and why.
I think adding to that, Henry, is that I think we could phrase that as a historical, generational history of institutional racism that has existed in this community for a long, long time. And perhaps the only way that we're going to deal with it is by having some type of process by which the leaders on a regional basis and the city get together and agree on some common vision, goals, commitment, and action in terms of what we're going to do to solve this problem that was created on a regional basis in terms of why kids in Rochester right now are living in the conditions and having the results in schools that they are right now. It's not simply because they're inferior. They're not. It's because of this long history of institutional racism and classism that has been forced upon them.
Vicki, do you think the community wants a serious conversation on this, though?
I think the community needs a serious conversation. If we don't start talking about it, it's never going to happen. We've always been this, oh, we can't talk about segregation because it'll never happen. Well, we've got to start. And I think one of the ways we can start is for more white people to stay in the city and send their kids to city schools. They can do just fine. My kids have had a fantastic education. My son just graduated last year. He's going to college now at a great school. My daughter's a sophomore at Wilson, looking forward to the IB program next year. And I think that if people would just look at city schools, look at the individual schools, think about how you could get involved, we can incrementally desegregate what we can. And then maybe people can stop being quite so afraid. We can address some of the racism so that the people from the Black community that care deeply about education as well are not running away from the city schools. Because urban suburban is a great program for the suburbs. It gets those people of color out in the suburbs. It hurts city schools because you have the families that are most committed. I don't blame the families for leaving. There's all sorts of very valid and good reasons that they do. But it does hurt the city schools.
Do you have white friends who express surprise that you send your kids to school in the city?
Oh, regularly, sure. Most of my friends now are in the city, but friends from the suburbs or something like that, they either think I'm crazy or they think I'm some incredible hero that I'm doing this, but it's something that nobody else could do. It's not. My kids have been able to learn so much more by going to school with all these different people. They learned Spanish at school 12. They're going to school at Wilson, which is about 90% people of color, and they're comfortable in that world, and they're comfortable in the white world. They're able to code switch between the two, and they've been challenged. The IB program has kids from all over the world that are participating in that. But will people say to me, oh my gosh, how could you do that regularly?
Yeah, as a Puerto Rican who's been a teacher, a parent, an administrator, an advocate for our rights as a community to have quality bilingual education. My children went to the district schools, and my daughter graduated from college. My other daughter has attended college, is doing well in her work right now. And I can only say that for me, as a kindergarten teacher most of my career, parents would be expressing this type of concern about their children and the schools. And we saw two things happen. One, they either made a thoughtful decision either way, to continue in the program, or usually it was, let's get the best out of kindergarten because the suburban district where we're going to go doesn't provide a full day kindergarten. Plus, they're getting immersed in a second language, learning more ways of seeing things and being with people. So there's, for me, a perspective that comes from that experience.
So let's talk about what the coalition wants to do. They've got recommendations, and there's a community forum coming up two Tuesdays from now on October 29th. That event, let's get a little bit more information if we can. Dan, what do you want the community to know about that?
Well, we're co-sponsoring it with the Brockport College Department of Education, Health, and Human Services. Also, Great Schools for All is working with us, and the Southwest Common Council Education Committee. So we've got a lot of people behind this, a lot of people involved. Members of the coalition have probably over 1,000 years of experience, educational experience among us. We've got former superintendents, ex-principals, teachers, parents, concerned citizens who are involved in putting this thing together. So we're hoping folks will come and share their ideas. We'll be sharing what the recommendations are about and then giving them the opportunity to share their opinions as well and hopefully modify even what we have. So it's a transparent process and it's a participatory process, too, to get as many people from the community involved as possible.
What time and where?
4 to 6:30 at the downtown Brockport campus on the corner of Court and Chestnut.
4 to 6:30, that's on Tuesday the 29th if you want to mark your calendars and get involved there. But I don't know if you're going to find anybody with opinions on education, Dan. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah, there's not many out there.
Well, the Coalition has recommendations, and I'm going to go ahead and read from them, and then what I'd like you is kind of walk me through exactly what you mean. Because this community now knows the term distinguished educator, but it took a while to figure out exactly what that means or how it was defined. Well, you've got education facilitators. You urge that the chancellor, the board of regents, and the commissioner, with RCSD board of education input, appoint for a period of 2 years two education facilitators. One, an urban experienced educator with skills in research-based curriculum development, pedagogy, assessment, group process, and providing services to combat poverty and trauma, and an educator administrator with financial planning skills and experience. An education facilitator. Who are the? Define a little bit more of that for me.
Well, we had trouble with that because we didn't like the term distinguished educator.
I wonder why.
Yeah, right. Because so many people want to be distinguished educators, but would like to be labeled that as well. But I think the issue here really is that we're looking for education leaders, experts in those fields that we mentioned, that the combination of the board, the superintendent, the Board of Regents and the commissioner to be appointed would select and appoint to advise, help, and to work with the superintendent and the board in terms of achieving not only our recommendations, but others as well that I'm sure are on their plate.
Okay.
So I don't see why the board or the superintendent would have a problem with accepting more help. I mean, these aren't going to be people who tell them what to do, but who would be there to assist, advise, give ideas, and be a resource for them.
Paid?
Yes. And in fact, there was a recent bill that was passed in terms of Hempstead, New York, which was an intervention by the legislature in which they have three appointed distinguished educators or facilitators who are paid for by the state. So as opposed to Jaime Aquino, who was paid by the district, this could be a precedent for state paid.
Okay. What do you see the benefits here, Vicki?
Well, I think the big difference between the distinguished educator is it's not meant to be a somebody who's generating a report or an overseer. I focus in on the financial planning one. Obviously, district finances are incredibly opaque. I think that's one of the reasons we have trouble getting the money that we need to support the kids in trauma, because nobody can figure out where exactly that money goes. When you look in the schools, you can see that you need more reading teachers, you need more counselors, you need more money. But when people do the math and divide total number of students by the total, or take the budget and divide by the total number of students, it comes up with this huge number. And you're like, how can it be a money problem? We need to understand where that money's going. And I think that is something that an outside person can do better than somebody who has strictly internal and has to meet their boss's demands. This is someone who's going to come in pre-fired. They're hired for a two-year term, you know, for 2 years, and then they're gone. So they don't have to worry about keeping feathers smooth, and can really dig in and tell us where that money's going. As Dan said, it costs more to educate kids in poverty. So that number might be correct. I know for a fact some of that money is extra money spent on transportation. The district has to transport, you know, everybody. Whether they're going to private schools or parochial or charter schools and all of that. There's a lot of extra costs for special ed, things like that. But we need to really understand that and have a transparent process. As an involved parent, when the budget comes out, I want to know, how is this going to impact my kid's education? And especially the last couple years, I have not been able to tell. I could dig in for hours, go to meetings, and there's just no credibility of what the budget's going to tell.
Well, and on the subject of the budget, obviously they're dealing with a $30 million plus gap that caught, I think, many people by surprise. And I don't want to speak for a board member like Willa Powell, who was on this program recently, but I don't know that she would agree with you entirely that we don't know where the money's going or we don't know how to get the money for kids impacted by trauma. I think, do you feel like that there is is it intentionally opaque? You use the word opaque.
I do feel to some extent it's intentionally opaque. Huh. It's very difficult to divide out money for schools versus money that's kept at a high level, because you never know from one year to the next. Well, the coaches are going to be paid from the district level. Oh, no, now the coaches are allocated at schools. You don't know where the funding streams are.
Do you think it's too top heavy?
In general, yeah.
I mean, that was one of the findings that Dr. Aquino had, too top-heavy, and that there may be ways to sort of reallocate where money is going. And so let me ask you, Vicki, instead of, sort of pushing you on the idea that the coalition has of hiring two education facilitators, at least one with financial planning skills, you have someone like Beatrice LeBron on the board whose stock in trade is financial oversight. Why not give her even more authority and say, really, that's who you are. I mean, this role is going to go to someone who's already on the board.
Because we need somebody who can do it full time. Beatrice LeBron is already doing a second job as a board member. She's doing a great job as that. She's a very effective board member and was reelected. But that's not fair to say to her, here, take on a third job.
Okay, so you're saying you want this role, you need it full time. And it has to be laser-focused on the district.
Yes.
Okay.
Wanted to comment one thing, that the education expert in curriculum, group dynamics, and so on that we're recommending to be an associate of the financial facilitator, that person could play another role, too. As we know from history of the board, that they've had a lot of difficulty in terms of conflict on the board and resolving their differences. In fact, I think Jaime Aquino, recommended that there be a conflict resolution recommendation that would go to solve their problems. If this educational facilitator that we're recommending could be there on a continuous basis, not just call when needed, or not just making a dog and pony show in terms of how to do it and then getting up and leaving, you could have an ongoing person to do group process and call attention to the issues that are preventing effective communication, be it on finances or be it on instruction.
Is it your vision, Dan, that the education facilitators, both of them, would be local?
I think that's the leaning of our coalition, is that a person who's local has more knowledge, more experience with the board, and hence it would probably be a much better idea, especially given traveling commitments and everything else that they would have.
Henry, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Absolutely.
And so when it comes to the rest of the recommendations, listeners, we should try to link you to it online, because before you go to the forum on the 29th, you probably want to digest it. We could probably, as I'm learning this hour, do an hour on each recommendation. And there are quite a lot. Can people find it online, Dan?
Yes, they can. I think it would probably be best, Evan, if you can give your contact information for email, and I can give it to you so that you could distribute
it. Send
it
to me,
here.
And we're going to post it on our platforms as part of the podcast for this conversation. So WXXINews.org/connections for all the episodes, and we attach relevant information. We will attach these recommendations, because as I go through the list here, well, in our second half hour, we'll get through as much of it as we can. And I want to talk about one phrase that comes up so often and that you'll find on recommendation number 5, and that's community schools. I can't tell you how often listeners say, what exactly is the definition of a community school, and why does it matter? We will ask the coalition for their thoughts on that recommendation as we talk about the work that they're doing in regards to RCSD. Dan Dermisich is here, a coalition coordinator and a retired principal of the School Without Walls. Vicki Robertson is a parent in the Rochester City School District and a member of the school-based planning team at Wilson Commencement. Henry Padron, retired school number 12 kindergarten teacher and a former RCSD bilingual program director. Let's go ahead and get our only break and right back to their recommendations next. This is Connections, and I'm going to go ahead and read the 5th recommendation on the list from the coalition, the Rochester Coalition for Public Education, a local organization dedicated to sharing what it calls progressive education research with the public and with policymakers. They are not particularly interested in a state takeover of the school board or mayoral control. In fact, they think those are bad ideas. They want research-based decision-making and policy. And here's number five on their list of recommendations. Number five, requiring the superintendent, in consultation with the New York State Education Commissioner, to convert all schools identified as comprehensive support and improvement schools to community schools with funding from New York State, with a specific focus on providing services to those students and families experiencing trauma from poverty-related conditions. And to that end, the 1.5-mile minimum busing requirement in New York State's busing reimbursement formula will be waived to allow parents the ability to choose safe busing for their child to their neighborhood school. Principal Dermisich, a community school is a neighborhood school, are they the same thing? People ask this all the time. Let's get some definitions first.
Well, it could be either, the way I read it. You could have a school such as School Without Walls that draws kids from all over the district. Could they be a community school? Absolutely, if there's an emphasis on providing the services, the wraparound services that they need to address the issues of poverty and trauma with those kids and their families. I think if it's a neighborhood school, I think there's the opportunity for much more to happen because of the support from the community for it, the distance they would have to walk, and also receive services themselves right there and then at that school. School 17 is a great example in terms of how they've made significant progress with kids who are suffering socially and emotionally from poverty. So there's a lot of gray areas in it. There's not a real fixed definition, but I would say the key issues are having community agencies on board to provide the wraparound services to deal with the poverty and trauma issues that kids and families are experiencing.
So if, as your plan calls for, we convert all schools identified as comprehensive support and improvement schools to becoming community schools, don't they already have those services and programs in place? No?
Well, they have some, but it's limited. I think both Henry and Vicky can comment on this from their experience at the schools that they're at. But if you look at the ideal model, which the mayor keeps referring to in terms of 17 school, they had over 60 organizations from the county and the city involved in providing services to that school. Now, if you looked at that in terms of what would it cost to provide those services to all other schools in the city school district, because, I mean, there's kids in every school that are suffering from poverty and trauma. But as to whether or not the district can afford that out of its budget, despite the fact that it's reaching close to $1 billion, I don't think it could. There's going to have to be a massive influx of money in order to make that happen if they expect it to follow the model of School 17.
Okay. Community schools.
Tremendous challenges. For me, the awareness that over 17% of the city school district's student body are who we call new English language learners. 17%. How were they determined to be new English language learners? Who are they? And what do they receive as a result of all of this? We also have different model programs in different schools. For the elementary level, there's the transitional model, there's the one-way dual language, and the two-way dual language. The high schools have different continuations of these programs. We have School 15 that is a total ESL, English for New Language Learners, and RIA, the RIA International Academy, similar to School 15. How will the Language Assessment and Placement Center be able to reconfigure how they disperse these families to these different schools with these different models and reimagine it as a community school? Will it be able to adequately fill the seats? Will there be more seats than they can fill? I'm coming at today's interview from the perspective of language learners in this district. So that for me is another level of a challenge that we will have to face.
How do you feel about community schools, Vicki?
I think community schools, I'm a little different than Dan. I think for community schools to really be a community school, they need to be a neighborhood school. That one of the big challenges is parent involvement in a school. And it's so much easier if they're in the neighborhood. My kids went to school 12. We walked across the street to go to be to the school, and we could be involved and engaged. And those parents that were in the community could do that. I think it's for some special schools, like a school without walls, you could do it at a community school. But in general, if those services aren't there where the people are who need those services, they're not going to get used. I mean, why would somebody go across town to go to their kid's school to get services? We need to find ways to pull people into their own schools. And I think so community schools that are neighborhood schools, I think, make a huge amount of difference. And that's why they talked about that 1.5-mile busing thing, because people are busing. One of the cost drivers are buses going all over the city. And we need to not have people using busing as childcare. We need to provide that wraparound care so that they can get their kid to school and then get the care they need.
I think that's an important point, though, the busing, that the idea would be that if all kids within a neighborhood school district had free busing rather than being at the 1.5-mile limit, that you would get more parents who are interested in going to a neighborhood school. I mean, if you're at 1.4 or 1.3, a parent may be saying, I still question the safety of my child walking to school. But if I had a bus, I'll send them. So that's the big difference in terms of having that 1.5-mile waived for children who are within a neighborhood school district.
And School 17 is perhaps a case study as an example of how might it be replicated in other pockets of the city where there are concentrations of particular languages that will get bilingual education, as well as the other languages. How might that play out using School 17 as a model?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan, you're pretty well plugged into the people who are making decisions at the district level. What do they make of these ideas on community neighborhood schools and bringing people closer to their schools, getting more involved, offering more programs? Is it a matter of money?
I think it is a matter of money. I think ideally, I don't think the board members, I mean, we've spoken to Van White, the board president. We've spoken to two of the new board members and Liz Hallmark, who's leaving the board. And they all seem to favor community schools. Money is an issue. There's no question about it. The other thing that's the problem, and I think it relates to some degree what Henry was talking about, is that if we're looking at the end result in terms of what do we want from these schools, many leaders, policymakers in our district are simply looking at test scores. Test scores are the big and overall issue. And as long as we're driven that way, we're going to be driving away from the other issues that kids are facing. And we're going to be driving away from the kinds of things that excite kids in terms of learning and being involved and enjoying coming to school. Because if you only test math and reading or math and literacy, that's all you're going to have. If you're going to focus on other things, such as social studies and social issues and citizenship, then maybe students will be more interested in terms of project-driven learning, going out in the community, studying about issues, whether or not they be about race, whether or not they're about issues that they face, like hunger in America, whatever. Those could drive kids to not only be more interested in school, but also to get involved in terms of being political activists and change agents themselves.
Let me grab a phone call. This is Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Hate to call so much every week, but this is really interesting. You were talking about the budget, and it was said that, in somebody's opinion, that they believe that it was intentionally opaque, $30 million. I would say, I don't know, that confuses me. But anyway, it would seem like that would be a good place to start, is to nail down, investigate, find out what's going on with the the financial planner, they say she doesn't have time. That's the excuse with the money. So that would be a really good place to start before launching into community schools. I know you can do both at one time, but to identify the specific problem there. So intentionally opaque, $30 million. Wouldn't that be, well, they say follow the money, and I'm thinking about that too. Thank you very much, Evan.
Yeah, Jane, thank you. So on that subject, you know, to be clear here, when we talk about someone like Beatrice LeBron on the school board, the reason she has another job is that's what school board members do in just about every district. And even in Rochester, where there's been a debate about pay, they work other jobs, generally speaking. And Beatrice LeBron is one of them who does that. So the being on the board is not her full-time job. But there is a budget office for the district. And here's one of the frustrations I had as a journalist. I will be happy to put my ignorance on the table and say, I don't know exactly who puts every line of the budget together or who reviews every line when it's passed. However, when we talked to someone like Commissioner Willa Powell on this program, and I said, I don't mean to be so reductive here, but when you've got a $30 million gap and you've been on this board for more than 20 years, who's to blame here? How didn't we know? And she said, you know, well, I don't really know. I mean, there's not a direct answer for that. I think eventually we have to figure out how we got there. And to Jane's point, there needs to be more transparency and start from there. But I don't know if I'm asking the right. I mean, Dan, you've been closer in the RCSD. How do we ask the right questions so that the budget feels like it's more transparent?
Well, I think one of the answers is certainly not by having a state-appointed board come in. I think that we have to move more toward what Henry was talking about, again, in terms of having an educated community, opening the meetings to parents, to citizens who ask the right questions, and to have that financial advisor / facilitator, educator that we're talking about in terms of raising more questions and giving them the assistance that they need.
Now, again, it'd be two paid positions in a school budget. What's the overall annual budget? I mean, it's a big...
Close to $1 billion.
Close to $1 billion. So if you're paying two people and these recommendations are accepted, and instead of one distinguished educator, which sometimes can carry this patina of kind of this czar figure, as opposed to two education facilitators who are advising the board and the district, then it might feel a little differently. At least that's kind of the feel I'm getting. So Jane, I appreciate that. I think everybody wants more transparency. That's valuable. Let me ask our guest to kind of take you through some of the other recommendations, because we can't get through them all. We're down to our last less than 10 minutes. Henry, what stands out to you that is something that if you were choosing off a menu of the recommendations and you couldn't do them all, but you want to tick a box on what you need to get done to help RCSD, what stands out?
A fundamental understanding of what are the requirements for new English language learners. What is required to be meeting the needs of this population based on the best practices, the best research, all the little TikToks that you can give it, and how are they being implemented in this district, and then how can those be enhanced? Which ones do need to be revisited? Which ones need to be perhaps put to the side? But have that required adequacy and understanding what this means to do. And that can go off into another mumble jumble of titles and words and what have you, another show.
I don't think it's mumble jumble at all. Vicki, what's on the top of the list for you?
Well, I have to say parent involvement is one of our things, and it's something that's always on any list of what we should do to improve the schools. And it's very easy to say and really challenging to do. But there are times when we've done it successfully. There's schools that have got strong parent groups, and we need to make sure that the district doesn't just try to start from scratch, but tap those existing groups, like the Parent Leadership Training Institute, like the coalition that worked on the code of conduct that was a mix of parents and community members, that really worked effectively to reach out and identify parent leaders. At the same time, we also have to work hard at making schools more welcoming. and finding ways to get past some of the cultural issues. You know, when people say a PTA, they think of a bunch of white women baking cookies. And it's got to be more than that and different from that. I just think that meaningful parent connections, using the parent community, parent groups, and the parent leaders that already exist is an important thing to do.
But I see an interconnectedness of your proposals, because if there are more community and certainly more neighborhood schools, you get a better chance of getting more
Absolutely.
Involvement there. Okay. Dan, what's on the list of really the tops for you?
Well, the one that I think that could make the most difference would be if the board had a standing committee, not a special advisory committee, which lasts for, I think, 90 days or something, but a standing committee, an advisory board consisting of two teachers, two administrators, a education professor from all the local colleges, having parents on the board, even students. And this, the role of the board, of this advisory board, would be to present on a monthly basis or on demand from the board and the superintendent research on a problem that they're facing. What is it that has been proven to work? For example, what's the best time to start school for elementary kids versus secondary kids? What should we do about high-stakes standardized testing? Are there alternatives out there? What should we do about bilingual education? You know, what do the experts say about this? So on need-based, in terms of what the superintendent and the board would be asking for, as well as the board itself meeting on a regular basis and saying, look, based on our observation of what the district needs, we need to do more work in this specific area, for example, high-stakes standardized testing and providing performance-based alternatives for kids rather than standardized exams. If that were what they wanted and the board was hopefully receptive to the research, which, by the way, you know, could make a huge difference. But if we're thinking about who's on the board, are these people who have studied education? Do they have time to read the research? Have they experience with kids in terms of what works? Very few members of either the Board of Regents or Boards of Education around the state have that kind of experience. If we had an advisory board that was composed of experts and practitioners, I think we could make a difference.
Are you optimistic right now that the community is going to embrace these kinds of recommendations instead of the kinds of recommendations laid out in a menu by the governor or the mayor of Rochester?
I'm optimistic if we can do what Henry suggested before, and that's reach people in the community about what could be done versus rolling the dice and having an appointed board or a mayor who has very little educational background in terms of what it means to be an educator and an education policymaker. I'm optimistic that if we can have more people attend our forums and put pressure on the Board of Education, put pressure on the City Council, that this is what we want, I think we can make a difference.
And I think this will be an instructive way to help close the program as we get you ready for their event, this forum that's coming up starting at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, October 29th, in which the Rochester Coalition for Public Education, working with a number of other organizations, putting on this community forum. They want your feedback on these recommendations and hoping to get more community consensus on what would help strengthen Rochester City School District. I'll start with you, Dan. I'll ask all three of you to kind of offer some brief thoughts on this. Why do you think we've seen such heated calls for a state takeover, mayoral control? Instead of saying, what's the research say? How do you work within a district with this much poverty? Why is the focus so heated in that direction right now?
That's really a good question, Evan. In terms of why, I would say that people in general do not know the research, so they tend to go to the familiar in terms of, well, the problem is it's the kids, or it's the teachers, or it's the union, or you know, we don't have enough money or whatever. Maybe it's a combination of some of those things, but without knowing what the research is, being, you know, the old phrase about let's never pool ignorance makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, people just don't know from the top down in terms of what the research says works well with urban kids. And if we don't look at that, and hopefully we will, through this effort for the coalition, we can begin to make a difference. But if we don't, we're doomed to do the same old, same old.
30 seconds. What do you think?
I think for why, you have to look at who would benefit by mayoral control or other takeover type things and why they would be wanting that.
Very direct there. Henry, what do you think?
To do so from a understanding of what it means based on having received information that made you come to that decision. That information should be coming to you in whatever language you speak, from whatever culture you represent, whether it be in the temple, in the church, in the street, at the school, at the bodega, wherever it may be. An informed population will make an informed decision.
Thanks to all three of you for your time. And on Tuesday, the 29th, starting at 4 o'clock, where, Dan?
Is the downtown form? Brockport campus on the corner of Court and Chestnut Streets.
Court and Chestnut Streets on the 29th, starting at 4 p.m., a community forum on these recommendations for improving the state of affairs in the Rochester City School District. Representing the Rochester Coalition for Public Education this hour, Henry Padron, Vicki Robertson, Dan Dermisich. Thanks to all three of you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Evan.
Thank you.
And our thanks as well to Josephine Perini for the outstanding work as a volunteer with us today. Gary Puttup working for us behind the glass. Megan Mack is the producer. And Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.